Hello, everyone. Greetings from rural Australia. We're a little bit early, a couple minutes early, but we wanted to make sure that everybody who is online is receiving the broadcast okay. If you're having problems, go ahead and post something in the chat space, and we'll see what we can do about that.
35 people.
Okay. Also, we'd ask you, except for having problems, to not be entering on the chat room messages during the talk here. We'll have you give you an opportunity to ask questions at the end of the talk, which you can do through the chat room. So we'll just wait for a second here to make sure that there aren't any real pressing problems with the broadcast, and then we'll start. I'll talk for maybe an hour. And then we'll leave time at the end for questions and answers.
So, everyone says that they can hear you fine.
All right, good. Yep. So it sounds like it's all working well. This teaching was originally a thank you teaching, a special teaching for those who contributed to the Mahasukha Kula Retreat Scholarship Fund. And for those people who are online or are going to watch this later who did that, thank you very much. We're very grateful. This is a scholarship fund that we use to support people in long-term retreats. There are six such recipients of our scholarship who are in three-year retreat presently in different places around the U.S. And then we use the money also to support people who are doing something less than that, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 3 months. It's very important that people have an opportunity to do retreat, and most people who have dedicated their lives to the Dharma in such a way that they are interested in doing retreats and are qualified and so forth don't really have a lot of money. So if you're watching this broadcast and you haven't contributed to the Mahasukha Kula Retreat Scholarship Fund, I request that you do so. This of course, is free, is freely given, but it would be nice if you went to www.retreatscholarship.org and made a contribution. It can, just be 10 bucks, 20 bucks, 30 bucks, whatever you can afford, or even better, something ongoing, like a dollar a day, to keep our fund going. So that said, I'm also grateful that people who are watching live have foregone the start of the Super Bowl. You will be able to catch up, I think, by halftime at least, if you're really interested in watching grown men playing ball with one another. But in the meantime, we'll talk some Dharma, shall we? This talk is called The Buddha Taught No Dharma. The Buddha Taught No Dharma. And I'll explain, the whole talk will be about explaining what that means, or what I think it might mean. One of the things that this talk is about is what's called dependent origination. Dependent origination is how things do exist. Things exist dependently and not independently, according to Buddhist philosophy. Nothing exists independently. Nothing exists independently at all. So you can say the Buddha does not exist independently, teaching does not exist independently, and the Dharma doesn't exist independently. None of those things exist independently because nothing exists independently. Things exist only dependently. So we'll have a chance to talk about what that means and the implications of dependent origination when it comes to the phrase, the Buddha taught no Dharma. The other thing that this talk is about is the resistance to the idea that there is such a thing as Buddhist orthodoxy. As Buddhism comes to the West especially, and worldwide, of course, but we have an opportunity now to shed some of the accretions that Buddhism has accumulated over the course of centuries in Asia, and one of them is that it became an ism, it became a doctrine, it became an ideology, it became a religion, and then of course factionalized into the different the different kind of sects and the different kinds of strands and so forth. And this was not the intention of the Buddha, if there was a Buddha, and this was not the intention of the Buddha at all. The Buddha taught no Dharma, and in the sense of the Buddha did not teach an orthodoxy. And so one of the purposes of this talk is to encourage, especially new Buddhists, convert Buddhists in the West, to not grasp onto Buddhism as another orthodoxy. to not grasp onto Buddhism as another club that you can join vis-a-vis other clubs versus other clubs. This is not the intention of the Buddha Dharma. It is not my understanding that that's what the Buddha taught. If the Buddha taught anything. So let's begin, shall we? The starting point for the quotation, the Buddha taught no Dharma, is actually in the Digha Nikaya. The Digha Nikaya is part of the Pali canon, which is also known as Sutra in Mahayana Buddhism, or the Kangyur in Tibetan Buddhism. The Digha Nikaya 3.1.35, where it states that the Buddha taught Dharma from the time of his enlightenment to his parinirvana. So, I don't know, some 40 years or so. The claim is that the Buddha was teaching Dharma from the time of his awakening, his enlightenment, to the time of his parinirvana, his leaving the body in this lifetime. He taught the Dharma. The Pali Canon, you know, is a very ancient, early form of early record of Buddhism, and its appeal is very, very large in especially in Western Buddhism, partly because it seems to be a kind of a reportage of of what the historical Buddha really did, and then you have this sort of subsequent literature that we call Mahayana Buddhism, that we categorize as Mahayana Buddhism. You know, the most famous of which are texts that I'll quote in this teaching, the Heart Sutra and the Diamond Cutter Sutra. And these were written much later, 600-800 years later. And so they sort of have a different kind of a status, especially in some circles in the modern West, where they seem to be, late, they seem to be, maybe not the words of the Buddha at all. That the Pali Canon is really the authoritative, historical text. So one of the things that we need to I'd like to think about in this next hour or so is, what it means to portray the Buddha, Gautama Buddha, as a historical figure, and whether there is any evidence at all, whether there is any reasonable, sort of rationale for thinking of the Buddha that way. And if so, if the Buddha was only a historical figure, what the ramifications of that might be. And so we'll work on that a little bit. The Buddha taught the Dharma from the time of his enlightenment to his parinirvana. Then we read in Aryanagarjuna, from the root verses on the middle way, Mula Madhyamaka Karaka, from the 25th chapter, 24th verse. Peace, Shiva in the Sanskrit, Shiva, is the pacification of all perception and all conceptualization. So nirvana is the pacification of all perception and all conceptualization. And then in the Sanskrit, na kva chitkasya, chitkashchiddharmo, buddhena deishita. The no dharma whatsoever, na kva chitkasya. Chitkashchid, no dharma whatsoever was ever taught by the Buddha. No dharma whatsoever was ever taught by the Buddha. This is a radical assertion, especially for Buddhists. Of course, Nagarjuna is quite good at that. Nagarjuna is quite good at, kind of getting into the face of Buddhists themselves. In my opinion, much of what Nagarjuna wrote was for Buddhists, not for non-Buddhists. He was writing for the orthodoxy at the time. And so Nagarjuna is always kind of threatening to the orthodoxy. The Buddha taught no dharma. No dharma whatsoever. I mean, the Sanskrit is very strong. It's not like he taught a little bit of dharma. Or sometimes taught dharma. No dharma whatsoever was ever taught by the Buddha. So this, maybe you can say, well, maybe that's just Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna is just being provocative or unique or anomalous. Maybe it's just anomalous kind of like a assertion on the part of Nagarjuna. But sure enough, things... Other texts, similar kinds of statements are made. This is from a text called the Sutra on the Inconceivable Secrets of the Tathagata. This is put in the mouth of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva called Vajrapani. Shantamati, he's talking to somebody named Shantamati. From the night when the Tathagata became a complete Buddha, when he became enlightened, manifesting unsurpassed, perfect, complete enlightenment, until the night when he passed without remainder into final nirvana, parinirvana, the Tathagata did not speak even a single syllable, nor will he speak. So another text that sort of says the same thing. The Buddha taught no Dharma. The Buddha said nothing. Then Diamond Cutter Sutta, from the 13th verse. What do you think, Subuddhi? Has the Tathagata taught any Dharma at all? And what do you think Subuddhi says? Subuddhi answers, no. The Tathagata has not taught any Dharma at all. So it's not just Nagarjuna. It's not just in Nagarjuna. You can find it all over the place. At least in several different texts. The idea that the Buddha taught no Dharma. We'll also see later on in this talk that that Chandrakirti, who was a great commentator on Nagarjuna, also says the same thing. He affirms it. And in a very interesting way, actually, as we'll come to it. So I thought we'd just go through the three parts of this radical statement, that the Buddha taught no Dharma. The Buddha taught no Dharma. So we can arrange the kind of questions around those three things. Who was the Buddha? Who is the Buddha? How does the Buddha teach? Or does the Buddha teach at all? And what Dharma did the Buddha teach or didn't teach? Okay, so who's the Buddha or who was the Buddha? How does the Buddha teach or what did the, you know, or did the Buddha teach at all? And what Dharma did he teach if he taught anything at all? What is the Dharma that he taught or didn't teach? The Buddha taught no Dharma. So let's start with the Buddha who taught no Dharma. Who was the Buddha? And if you say, you know, the Buddha was a historical figure, you have to use the past tense, that the Buddha was, that the Buddha used to be. And of course, this is the understanding of a certain form of Buddhism historically, and it is the form of understanding of the Buddha that we're all in the modern West attracted to, because we're all quite influenced by history as an understanding of the past, history as the understanding of the past, as opposed to other forms of understanding of the past, like, for example, mythology, a more traditional understanding of stories about the past. But the stories that we tell about our past, about the past, are the authoritative stories that we tell about the past in the modern era are historical. So to say that the Buddha was a historical figure means that the Buddha existed, that there really was a Buddha who, and note the past tense, the guy named Gautama, you know, Shakyamuni, who walked around in India, you know, 2,500 years ago and taught the Dharma. The Buddha taught the Buddha who taught no Dharma was that Buddha. was that historical Buddha. And so, you know, in certain temples in Southeast Asia, they represent the historical Buddha like this. They represent him as in the form of footprints, big footprints, which is kind of an interesting symbol. It means, you know, it's sort of like, you know, those statements that you see sometimes in colonial homes, you know, George Washington slept here or something like that, you know. The footprint says the Buddha walked here. The Buddha was here. But also, he ain't here no more, right? He's gone now. It's just footprints that are left behind. So if we say that the Buddha was a historical figure only, then the Buddha ain't here no more. The Buddha was, you know, and then the whole question, well, who was the Buddha, and what did the Buddha really say, and when did the Buddha really live, and all these historical questions arise. The same kinds of questions that arise for other religious leaders. And so in the Buddhist case, you know, especially the Western, you know, Western influenced Buddhism, we are just at the beginning of a process, you know, that the Christians have been all over for at least a century, maybe longer now. You know, the search for the historical Jesus. And the search for the historical Buddha will have exactly the same trajectory, if not a worse one. Most people have given up on the search for historical Jesus. It's futile. It's futile to try to find the historical Jesus. And it's going to be as futile to find who the historical Buddha was, too. What the historical Buddha really, who he really was, where he really lived, what he really said, will have the same kind of problems. It does have the same kind of problems that the search for historical Jesus has. Because these figures, Jesus and the Buddha, are buried in, you know, in mythology, in dogma, in religious doctrine, in theology. and to uncover anything historical from that, you know, mound of mythology is going to be very, very, very difficult, if not impossible. And, you know, if you're interested in this kind of thing, you might, you know, kind of educate yourself a little bit about the trajectory that the search for the historical Jesus has undergone, and think whether or not it's going to be the same with the Buddha, if not worse, actually, if not worse. So that's one sort of reason why maybe we shouldn't conceptualize the Buddha as historical, because to try to find the historical Buddha is going to be impossible. Secondly, another reason why maybe the Buddha that we're talking about, who taught no Dharma, isn't a historical figure, is because we have a kind of an attachment to a certain understanding of history that is actually non-Buddhist. An attachment to history as if history existed objectively, out there, independently on its own, a narrative of experience, of events that we just sort of register, that we kind of register or reflect. And of course, modern historians don't even believe this. This is a view of history, you know, that's at least 100, 150 years out of date. That the historian just objectively looks over the data of the past and then replicates it, retells the story of what actually happened. History exists dependently. And the search for the historical Buddha will exist dependently. On what? On the person trying to find it. On the historian, in other words. History exists dependently on who's telling history, doesn't it? You see? And history is told differently by different historians, of course, and history changes. As historians change, as the times change, then the history changes. History exists only as a backstory for the present, and the present is constantly changing. History is always perspectival. It depends on the perspective of the teller of history. So the search for the historical Buddha will tell you a lot more about who's searching than it will about the historical Buddha. It'll tell us a lot more about ourselves as we look and try to sort of reconstruct who the historical Buddha will. That story will reflect the teller of the story far more than it reflects the object of the story. Far more, okay? The search for the historical Buddha is also sort of flawed in that sense, that it exists only as everything else does, dependently and not independently. There's no objective historical story about the Buddha or anything else. So we're attached to it, though. We're attached to the idea of some kind of self-existent history that would prove one thing or another about, you know, who the Buddha was, what the Buddha really said, and so forth. And this actually, it seems to me, is not a Buddhist doctrine. The idea that history exists independently, objectively, you know, as the true verification of, you know, of anything, let alone a historical Buddha, is not a Buddhist doctrine. Buddhism teaches that things exist dependently, not independently. And history is a wonderful example of how things exist dependently. History exists dependently on the teller of the history, not on what has happened, but on the teller of the history. So, Here's a little thing just to, you know, bake your noodle a little bit. Just to, like, something to think about, okay? What if there never was a historical Buddha? What if the historical Buddha never existed, you see? Would that matter? Would that matter to you as a Buddhist, if you are a Buddhist, you see? Would it matter at all? And hopefully at the end of this talk, you'll realize that it doesn't matter, actually. And in fact, probably better. It's probably would be a better thing if we let go of the idea of the historical Buddha. Because of the tense, you see. Because if the historical Buddha existed, then the historical Buddha is not here anymore. The historical Buddha is past. The past is past. Past is gone. And what good is a past Buddha? What good is a Buddha who doesn't exist anymore, you see? If you're interested in Buddhism, I'd say it would probably be good to have a Buddha who's here and now. Who's present, who's available, and not one who's dead and gone, who just left footprints behind, you see. So the real question here is, who is the Buddha? Who's the real Buddha? And as many of you know, in Mahayana Buddhism, the doctrine that was devised to deal with the idea, even an ancient idea, 2,000 years ago idea of a historical Buddha. The doctrine that was devised to deal with that by Mahayana Buddhism was the idea of three bodies of a Buddha, or sometimes expanded to four bodies of a Buddha. That the Buddha doesn't only exist in some kind of like, you know, form, physical form, the Nirmanakaya, what's it called, the Nirmanakaya. It doesn't exist in just one physical form, number one. That the Buddha can take infinite Nirmanakayas, infinite kinds of physical forms. Number two, that the Buddha has a Sambhogakaya, another kind of physical form that is kind of like the essence of inspiration, you could say. You know, sometimes the Sambhogakaya is represented as a sound, as the ultimate sound, as a syllable, for example, that is the source of all language, of all words, of all concepts. So behind all concepts, all syllables, all words, all knowledge, you could say, is the Sambhogakaya of the Buddha. And then, of course, the Dharmakaya is the real Buddha. According to Mahayana Buddhism, the Dharmakaya is the Buddha jewel, the real Buddha jewel. And the Dharmakaya is reality, the ultimate reality, the emptiness of ultimate reality. So you know, if that's who the Buddha is, then the Buddha isn't just some guy 2,500 years ago that we probably are never going to know much about, you know, actually. And, you know, apart from our own little, you know, stories about it, you know, apart from our own, like, projections about what happened back then, you know, the historical Buddha is pretty much unknowable to us. And maybe it doesn't matter at all who the historical Buddha was. Maybe there wasn't a historical Buddha. But there certainly is a Buddha. You know, according to Mahayana Buddhism, there is a Buddha who is present potentially all the time everywhere in one or another or all of the Buddha's forms. All the forms and all the bodies, what they call the bodies, the kaya. The Nirmanakaya, the Dharmakaya, the Nirmanakaya, the Sambhogakaya, and the Dharmakaya sometimes in two forms. So when you open up that concept, when you open up that idea of who the Buddha was, then the Buddha is not just a historical figure. In fact, the Buddha was probably not really principally a historical figure. That the Buddha is not was. That the Buddha is. So the Buddha taught no Dharma. Who's the Buddha, you see? Who's the Buddha who taught no Dharma? First question. Here's another sort of ramification of that, of the four bodies theory, actually. That if the Buddha wasn't a historical figure, or at least principally a historical figure, if the Buddha is available at all the times, well, where can I find a Buddha? You see, where could I find the Buddha? And the four bodies of the Buddha theory gives us two places to look. Number one, you know, inside ourselves, in our deepest recesses, in our own Buddha nature. The Buddha exists as part of our own Buddha nature, ongoingly, on an ongoing basis. So deep down inside of us, the Buddha is teaching, and we just need to listen a little bit better. And of course, it's hard to listen when, you know, nobody's helping you. So another way that the Buddha exists for us now is through our teachers, through our lamas, through a guru. And again, as many of you, I think, probably already know, in the Lam Rim texts of Tibetan Buddhism, there's a very, very simple proof that your lama, your guru, is the Buddha. See, the Buddha isn't Gautama Buddha 2,500 years ago. Your lama is the Buddha, potentially, you see, if you see him that way. And what's the proof? Well, what do Buddhas do? Well, how do Buddhas... do Buddhas exist? Yes, we say Buddhas exist. Do they want to help us? You say, well, yes. You know, what good would a Buddha be if the Buddha didn't want to help us? Can the Buddha help us? And then the answer to that is yes, they can. I mean, they don't only want to help us, but they actually can help us. They have the power to help us. And then we get, at that point, we sometimes get stuck, and we say, well, gosh, you know, maybe the Buddha isn't helping me because the Buddha hasn't fixed me, you know. The Buddha hasn't just, you know, waved the Buddha wand over my head and fixed me. I still suffer. And said, well, the Buddha can't help you that way. The Buddha can't help like that. And so, well, how is that? And then, well, how the Buddha is helping? How can Buddhas help me? He said, well, the Buddhas help by teaching. They teach you how to help yourself. They teach you how to help yourself. And then he goes, is anyone teaching you how to help yourself? We said, well, yes, my lama's teaching me how to help myself. Well, that's the Buddha. There they are. Where did you think they would be? What did you think a Buddha would be? You see, we have this kind of like cartoon, childish, mythologically based idea of Buddhas, that they have to look a certain way, or, you know, that they have to have rainbow bodies, or walk through walls, or drive around on Buddha mobiles, or something like that, you know, and it's just childish, it's just absurd. And the Buddhist texts do not teach that. The Mahayana Buddhist texts do not teach that that's how a Buddha exists. The Buddha exists in the higher forms, what I would regard as the higher forms of those Buddhist texts. They say that the Buddha looks just like us. The Buddha would come just like we do, in the form of our teachers, in the form of the people that are close to us, maybe, in the form of the people who can really help us by teaching us. You see, that's how they come. So again, from the Diamond Cutter Sutra, this is from the fifth verse of the Diamond Cutter Sutra, where Subhuti, the student, is asking the Buddha, does the Buddha have signs? And, you know, maybe you guys know, most of you know that according to some Buddhist literature, the Buddha has, you know, a certain number of signs, 40 major and 60-some minor or something, 110 total, I think. But in the Diamond Cutter Sutra, he says, no, Buddha doesn't have any signs. And so it's like, to the extent, this is from the sutra, when Subhuti had finished speaking, the Lord then said to the Venerable Subhuti, to the extent that there are distinctive physical marks, Subhuti, there is deception. That's false. And to the extent that there are no distinctive marks, physical marks, there is no deception. For the straightforward one, the Tathagata, is recognized by having the distinctive physical marks of no physical marks that are distinctive. In other words, the Buddha doesn't look anything different than any of us. You see, a Buddha would not look different from anyone else. A Buddha would be distinguished by his lack of distinguishment, by his appearance as a regular, normal person. And this is an awesome teaching. This is an awesome kind of idea. And it's not just in Buddhism that we find it. So I'll take just a moment here to plug another online teaching that we'll be doing over the course of 3 weekends in April and early May for the Yoga Studies Institute. You can go to yogastudiesinstitute.org, Yoga Studies Institute, one word, .org, and find out about it. It's on a text called the Ashtavaka Gita, a text from the Hindu Vedanta tradition. On the concept of Jivan Mukti being liberated in this very lifetime. And this is an amazing text on what a Jivan Mukta, somebody who is liberated in this lifetime, you know, what they would look like, what they would do, how they would behave, you know, what kind of life they would live, stuff like that. And I'll just sort of give away, you know, the bottom line on that, and that is they look exactly like us. They would not look different. They would not be walking through walls or floating around with angel wings. They would look exactly like us. The only thing that would change was the inside, you see. The only thing that needs to change is the inside, not the outside. So we're kind of attached to outside appearances, aren't we? We're attached to outside, the look that a Buddha should have. And if we don't see somebody who has that look, then they can't be a Buddha according to our, you know, very, very sophisticated understanding of what Buddhas can look like and what they can't. Okay? The Buddha. Who is the Buddha who taught no Dharma? See, think about it. Who is the real Buddha? Where is the real Buddha? Can you find a real Buddha in your life? And if the real Buddha is only a historical figure, you can't find that Buddha in your life, actually. Okay? That Buddha is just a story about somebody who lived a long time ago in the past. And a story told by somebody who's not like reporting the actual facts, but is just repackaging some kind of a tale, some kind of a story from their own perspective. The real Buddha is here and now, always as a presence with us always, and they come in very, very familiar forms. They could if we see them that way. Okay. So the next part of the phrase, this controversial phrase, the Buddha taught no Dharma, is the taught part. How does a Dharma teaching occur, actually? See, does a teaching occur with a teacher teaching? And that, of course, is how we think. We think of, I went to a Dalai Lama teaching and I got a teaching from the Dalai Lama. Or, you know, in the past, maybe people went and got teachings from the Buddha, who according to this controversial phrase, taught no Dharma. So the Buddha, they got a teaching from a Buddha who taught no Dharma. But anyway, so how does a Dharma teaching actually occur? Who's really teaching whom in any kind of Dharma teaching, including this one, you see, including this very one online, you know, broadcasts around the world? Who's teaching whom here? again, many of you know how the Diamond Cutter Sutra and the Heart Sutra, as well as many, many other Prajnaparamita sutras, Perfection of Wisdom sutras, begin. They begin with a very telling phrase. Evam maya shrutam. This is what I heard. You see, most of that, it's mostly assumed in the Prajnaparamita sutras that, or in any sutra, actually, that the one who heard this was Ananda, one of the Buddha's close disciples, who then who heard this and then repeated it at one or another of the conferences, of the big kind of conventions that the monks had early on, you know, after the Buddha's parinirvana, to try to collate all the teachings of the Buddha. Evam maya shrutam, says Ananda. Or maybe it was Subhuti, you know, somebody heard this. Evam maya shrutam. And it's interesting, it's a very, very crucial phrase, actually. Thus it was heard by me. And one very, very important aspect of that is, this is what I heard. What the Buddha or anyone else actually, teacher, actually said is unknowable. What I heard is what I heard, you see. Other people heard what they heard. But evam maya shrutam, this is what I heard. And that's where the teachings come from, actually. The teachings, the Buddha taught no dharma, the teaching part isn't from what the Buddha said or what any teacher says. It's what was heard, you see. And then the person who heard it says it again, and it was heard by someone else. And down you go. And there is no teaching of the Buddha or the teaching of any teacher that wasn't heard, you see. So teachings also exist dependently. They do not exist independently. There's no independent teaching, independently existing, objectively existing teaching that the Buddha taught. The teachings exist dependently on a teacher who's teaching and a student who's listening. And in fact, the weight of that dependently originating sort of relationship really lies on the student who's listening. Because that's the only teaching we know of, you see. We know what someone heard. And then they said it to someone else, and then someone else heard it, and down you go. And that's the only teachings that we have, isn't it, from the Buddha. So think about it again, something to put into your pipe and smoke a little bit. You know, whose teachings do we have? Are they really the Buddha's teachings? Or are they the teachings of somebody who heard them? You could say that all of Dharma has just been heard through the grapevine, like that old song, you know, heard it through the grapevine. It's all just been heard through the grapevine. All Dharma is just grapevine, okay, like that. Now, I mentioned before that Chandrakirti commented on that phrase by Nagarjuna, no Dharma whatsoever was ever taught by the Buddha. Here's what he says about that, actually. He says that the idea that the Buddha taught any Dharma, and now I'm quoting from Chandrakirti's commentary, arises only from the imagination of people who are dreaming and who are deep in the slumber of ignorance. The idea that the Buddha taught any Dharma arises only from the imagination of people who are dreaming and who are deep in the slumber of ignorance. In other words, all conceptions of what the Buddha taught, all conceptions, all ideas about what the Buddha taught, are coming not from Buddha, but from sentient beings. Evam maya shrutam. This is what I heard. It's not some self-existent Buddha who's teaching some self-existent Dharma. It's what was heard by a suffering sentient being who, according to Chandrakirti, in this kind of direct way, is, you know, deep in the slumber of ignorance, you see, as sentient beings are, you see. Even the Buddha was not taught any Dharma by the Buddha. According to the Diamond Cutter Sutra, verse 10, the Lord said, "What do you think, Subhuti? Is there any teaching whatsoever that the Tathagata has received from Dipamkara?" Dipamkara was the Buddha before Gautama. And so in Gautama's, you know, in the Buddha's previous life as a Bodhisattva, you know, he is represented as having teachings from Dipamkara, from the Buddha of that time, of an earlier era. What do you think, Subhuti? Is there any teaching whatsoever that the Tathagata has received from Dipamkara, the straightforward one, the superior one, the fully awakened one? And Subhuti replied, "No. No, Lord. There is not any teaching whatsoever that the straightforward one has received from Dipamkara." the superior one, the fully awakened one. The Buddha taught no Dharma, and the Buddha wasn't taught any Dharma by the previous Buddha, according to the Diamond Cutter Sutra. Here's another one from another verse from the Diamond Cutter Sutra that gets at the same thing. Those who saw me with a form, so this is the Buddha talking, those who saw me with a form, those who heard me with a voice, in other words, those who thought that I was a historical figure, that I was like somebody walking around, you know, teaching with a voice and walking around in a form, engaged in mistaken efforts. Such people will not perceive me, not perceive the real Buddha. Then the verse goes on, the Buddha is perceived through the Dharma. The Buddha is perceived through the Dharma. And then, the true guides, the true Aryas, they say, the true Sangha, the true guides are the Dharma bodies. The Dharma bodies, the emptiness. And their true nature is not to be known, nor can it be known. So we'll come back to this. The idea that the true Dharma, Saddharma sometimes is called in the text, Saddharma, the true Dharma, cannot be known, cannot be conceptualized, cannot be said. And that's what he's indicating here. Just as there's no self-existent Buddhas, there's no self-existent Dharma that can be taught, you see. The true Dharma is always in the web. The true Dharma is never expressible. The true Dharma is inexpressible. And as soon as the Dharma is expressed, it isn't the true Dharma anymore. It becomes locked into the prison house of language, into the world of conceptualization, of form, and so forth. So, and exists dependently on those who are speaking it and those who are hearing it. It starts to exist dependently originating reality and not an ultimate reality. The true Dharma is ultimate reality, and that true Dharma is not teachable. So this brings us into the next part of the controversial phrase, the Buddha taught no Dharma. So the Dharma part. So just as a little bit of a review, you could say that the historical Buddha, some kind of objectively existing Buddha, taught no Dharma. The Dharma is taught only by living Buddhas, you see. The Dharma can't be taught by historical Buddhas. So, because the historical Buddhas aren't teaching nothing. If there are historical Buddhas, they're gone. They're past. The only Dharma that could ever be taught would not be taught by a historical Buddha, but by a living presence who teaches you. So you know, you could say, yes, I was taught Dharma. I was taught Buddha Dharma. But you weren't taught Buddha Dharma by a historical Buddha. You were taught Buddha Dharma by your teacher, who is the Buddha, see? Not was Buddha, but is Buddha, you know, present tense. So the Buddha did not teach any Dharma. And in what sense? Did not teach any Dharma until and unless it was taught to someone, unless it was received. So, you know, this is again like, some of you may know that in the academic world, you know, in literary criticism, for example, the whole idea of the power of the reader, you know, is primary. It's the reception that matters, not the intention of the author so much. The intention of the author is unknowable, but the reception, you know, how evam maya shrutam, what did I hear? What did I read? See, that becomes primary, and so too with the Dharma. It's not what the Buddha taught. The Buddha did not teach any Dharma until and unless it had been taught to someone, until and unless it had been received by a student. What we know of Buddha Dharma isn't what the Buddha said, but what was heard. Okay? So that's just a little review of the first two parts, the Buddha taught, and then the no Dharma part. Third part of the statement, what is the status of the Dharma that was or was not taught by the Buddha? Buddha taught no Dharma according to the Nagarjuna. So a couple of ways that we can understand this phrase when it comes to the Dharma. The Buddha taught no Dharma that isn't subject to investigation and interpretation. Again, I think many of you know the typical trope in the Buddhist text is that the Buddha himself is said to have said that you should not take my word for it. You know, if I teach something, you should investigate it. You should investigate it in three ways. You should like gold, like you're investigating gold. You melt it. Melting it means you see if it accords to your own direct experience, pratyaksha. Then you cut it, you cut the gold, which means you test it against your own logic, especially inferential reasoning, anumana. Can you believe it? Can you believe it according to logic? So the first one is, can you believe it according to direct experience? The second one is, I'm going to test it according to my, you know, abilities to think logically about what makes sense or not. And then the third one is a rub it, means, you know, as a metaphor for, does it also accord with the authorities that I've already accepted in my life? Authorities for truth that I've already accepted in my life. Does this teaching accord with that? And the principle, there's two of these, agama, it's called agama in Sanskrit. The two of them are, does it accord with scripture? Does it accord with what I know about scripture? And do I believe that scripture is authoritative? If you believe that scripture is authoritative, then it's agama. And what my teacher says, what the Lama says. And that, again, requires you to have accepted the Lama or the Guru as an authoritative figure who would not lie to you, would not try to, like, fool you or, you know, lead you down the wrong path. So does the statement, does the Dharma accord with those three things? Does it accord with personal experience, with your direct experience? You know, does it make sense in your life? Does it accord according to the way that you've thought about it? Does it make sense logically to your mind? And thirdly, does it accord with what you're being taught by your teacher and by the scriptures that your teacher is teaching? And in many ways, number three is most important, you see. If the Buddha's Dharma is not according with to what your teacher is teaching, then it's not Buddha Dharma, actually, you see, because your teacher is the Buddha. The teaching, the Dharma that the Buddha taught, would be the teaching that your teacher is teaching you. That would be Buddha Dharma. And anything that doesn't accord with that is not Buddha Dharma. So that's one sense in which the Buddha taught no Dharma that isn't open to investigation into some kind of interpretation, like you would investigate gold. The Buddha taught no Dharma that wasn't relative to the situation, that wasn't relative to the audience that the Buddha was teaching. The classical example of this is what's known as the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma, that the Buddha taught three sort of sets of teaching, according to this theory. Three sets of teachings, one for one kind of audience, one for another kind of audience, and a third for another kind of audience. And you know, some of you who've studied ACI, Asian Classics Institute, Course 15, you know something about this. And if you haven't, I recommend that course to you. It's a Galupa take on the three turnings of the wheel, and that's an interesting one. The Buddha taught one thing to one people, then he taught, like, real stuff, emptiness. He taught real emptiness. And then he taught this other thing for people who got freaked out by emptiness, third turning of the wheel. But then if you read and get teachings from other traditions, non-Galupa traditions, turns out that from their point of view, the Buddha taught one thing to one people, the second thing, the emptiness thing, to another kind of people. And then he taught the highest thing, which is this kind of sophisticated, you know, fine distinction sort of teaching, to the third audience. So even the three turnings of the wheel are disputed as to which turnings are most authoritative and which aren't. So again, like, kind of ball's always in our court, isn't it? Always back to us to try to decide, like, well, you know, what's the real Dharma? What was the Dharma really that the Buddha taught? The Buddha taught no Dharma that wasn't relative to the situation. Here's another example of it. Also in Nagarjuna, we read in the 18th chapter, the 6th verse, Buddhists have taught that there is a self, and that there is no self. They've also taught that there isn't anything which is either a self or no self. So Buddhists have taught that there's a self, they've taught no self, and they've taught neither self nor no self. See, that covers all the bases, I think. So, you know, what's Nagarjuna saying? That the Buddhas are confused, or the Buddhas, like, didn't understand, like, what he wanted to say about this whole question of self. And then the first thing that Nagarjuna says is the Buddha taught that there is a self. And as you know, any sort of fledgling Buddhist knows, the one of the main principal orthodox doctrines, according to Buddhist canonical orthodoxy, is that there is no self, anatman. And so Nagarjuna says, no, the Buddha taught that there was a self. So why would the Buddha teach something that was so non-Buddhist? How could it be non-Buddhist if the Buddha taught it, actually? But anyway, what was the purpose? And so the purpose is relative to the audience. There was in ancient times an audience very similar to audiences that we often get in the modern, Western times, modern times. An audience that doesn't believe in any personal responsibility for actions. You know, that there is no such thing as karma. There's no such thing as, you know, cause and effect. No ramifications to my actions at all. So for people like that, the Buddha taught there's a self, don't worry. There's a self that will reap the effects of causes that self created in the past, you see. He taught the concept of self to people who didn't believe in personal responsibility. And then, you know, people got attached to the idea of the self, you know, as we will. And then he taught no self to the people who are attached to the concept of self. He taught no self. He said, no, there's no self. There's no enduring, ongoing, permanent entity called the self to people who got attached, you see. And by the way, just as a little footnote, the Buddhist scriptures are filled with such things. As soon as you get attached to one thing, you start to find that too has been taken away from you somewhere in the Buddhist scriptures. Somewhere it too has been taken away from you. The whole of the real Buddha Dharma, the ultimate Buddha Dharma, is to detach from all attachments, from all graspings. And we'll come back to that in just a few minutes. So the Buddha taught there is a self to some people. He taught there is no self to some people. And then he taught the highest thing according to the text. He taught that there is neither a self nor a no self. Because no self itself is just a doctrine. It's just a dogma. And it too is as empty as any other dogma. So as soon as people get attached to no self, let alone self, or get attached to no self as a doctrine, then the Buddha will come and take that rug out from underneath you too. He says, no, there's neither self nor no self. See, neither one. It is empty. Everything is empty. Including, of course, emptiness itself. So as soon as you get attached to emptiness, then the Buddha will take that one away from you too. So, oh, you know, things are empty. So now I've got something to hold on to by, you know, thinking that things are empty. And the Buddha will come and, you know, grab that one out of your hand too. He says, no, emptiness itself is empty. Just like everything else. So that's the second way in which we can understand the idea that the Buddha taught no Dharma. The Buddha taught no Dharma that wasn't relative to the audience and so forth. The Buddha taught no Dharma that isn't just provisional. The Buddha taught no Dharma that is ultimate, but only provisional. The Buddha taught no Dharma that isn't just, you know, useful for the time being. And the image that's often used here is the Buddha, the Dharma that the Buddha taught is like a raft. And the raft is meant to get you over the river of samsara. But when the raft has served its purpose, then you cast the raft away. It's only provisional. It's only useful for the time being. And I think every level of the Dharma is like that too, you can say. Every level of the Dharma, every aspect of the Dharma is like a rung on the ladder. And once you've mastered that rung, then you don't just stay on that rung. You don't just say, oh, you know, I see that there are other rungs above, but I like this rung, you see. And we get attached to things like that too, don't we? You know, as soon as we sort of master one part of the Dharma, then we get all attached to it, you know, to the extent that we've mastered any part of the Dharma. But, you know, we sort of think that we mastered some part of the Dharma, let's say. You know, so, oh, I've got real renunciation now, you see. I'm a real renouncer. You know, I'm a monk or I'm a nun or, you know, I'm a householder who doesn't have anything in their house. Or, you know, now I'm a real renouncer. And then we get attached to renunciation. And the Buddha Dharma, you know, is constantly sort of suggesting that there, as soon as you master one rung of the ladder, climb up to the next rung and let the lower rung go. And it's very difficult for us because of our tendency to attach. We don't want to move up to the other rung. We're comfortable. We get comfortable. We get into our comfort zone with some aspect of the Dharma, with some practice or another. And then when our teachers, usually it's, you know, at the instigation of our teachers who are constantly like kicking us out of nests and making us fly, you know, to some other nest that we get kicked out of later. You see, when we're forced to get out of our comfort zones, you know, it's difficult for us. We cling on. We don't want to leave. So the Buddha taught no Dharma that isn't just provisional, that isn't just like for the time being, you see. The only absolute Dharma that the Buddha taught, if the Buddha taught any Dharma, The only absolute Dharma that the Buddha taught is that there is no absolute Dharma. How's that? Okay? That there is no absolute Dharma that can be taught. The absolute Dharma that the only sense in which there is absolute Dharma is unteachable, is Dharma that can't be put into words. Any Dharma that's put into words is only provisional. It's relative, it's conditional, it's contingent, and it's and just provisional, just like a raft. Then finally, this one. There is no Buddha. Buddha taught no Dharma that is orthodox. And this is the main point I want to make, I think, with all of this. One of the main points I want to make with this teaching, that that Dharma is not just provisional or relative, but it's always always the Dharma that we can speak of is always conceptual, and therefore not ultimate. By being put into words, by putting Dharma into words, it is already relative. It is already sort of less than ultimate. So the idea of a Buddhist orthodoxy that can be spoken, a set of dogmas or doctrines, is an anathema to Buddhism itself. That Buddhism is by nature not orthodox. That real Buddha Dharma is intrinsically non-orthodox. There's no such thing as orthodox Buddhism, because as soon as you put Buddhism into words, it becomes less than orthodox. It becomes less than ultimate. So one of the great examples of this, you know, is the Heart Sutra, of course. So I'll just remind you of what the Heart Sutra says. And therefore, Shariputra, when seen from the viewpoint of emptiness, seen from the point of view of ultimate reality, there is nothing which takes form. There is no feelings. There is no discriminating capacities. There is no other mental factors. There is no consciousness. These are the five samskaras. There are no five samskaras. There are no eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, etc., etc. He goes through all of the senses, the objects of the senses, and the consciousnesses that link the objects of the senses to the senses. There is none of that. There is no ignorance and no stopping of ignorance and so on, right up to there being no old age and death and no stopping of old age and death. This is dependent origination, the 12 links of dependent origination. He says that too is just a relative Dharma. That's not an ultimate Dharma. From the point of emptiness, from the point of view of ultimate reality, that mainstay of Buddhist orthodoxy is not orthodox. It does not exist. There is no suffering, no cause of suffering, no cessation of suffering, and no path. Those are the four noble truths, four Arya truths. Heart Sutra denies them, negates them from the point of view of ultimate reality. You see, there is no wisdom, nothing to attain, and no lack of attainment. It goes on like that. Just negating. Negating all of Buddhist orthodoxy. The Heart Sutra is a great example of kind of what I'm talking about here in general, of a Buddhist text that negates Buddhist orthodoxy. Back to the diamond cutter for one last thing. The Buddha is perceived through the Dharma. Remember that verse? The true guides are the Dharma bodies. The true guides, the true Sangha, are the Dharmakaya of the Buddha. And their true nature is not to be known, cannot be known. Nor can it be known. Their true nature is not to be known, nor can it be known. This reminds me of the first verse of the Tao Te Ching, the famous sort of root text of Taoism. The Tao that can be talked about, the Tao that can be named, is not the true Tao. The Dharma that can be put into words, the Dharma that can be put into, you know, some kind of orthodox, you know, dogma, is not the true Dharma. The Dharma that... So in that sense, the Buddha taught no Dharma. The Buddha really taught no Dharma. In the text I quoted before from Vajrapani, the sutra on the inconceivable secrets of the Tathagata, I'll just repeat what I quoted before and then finish the quotation, which I didn't before. Shantamata, from the night when the Tathagata became a complete Buddha, passed without remainder into... manifesting unsurpassed, perfect, complete enlightenment, until the night when he passed without remainder into final nirvana, the Tathagata did not speak even a single syllable, nor will he speak. Why? Now this is the part that we didn't get to before. Shantamata, the Tathagata is constantly in absorption. the Tathagata does not breathe. So who's the Buddha? How could the Buddha teach any Dharma when the Buddha is in Nirvana, you see? When the Buddha is communing with ultimate reality, does not breathe, is constantly in absorption, then the Buddha has nothing to say, you see? That's ultimate reality. That's ultimate Dharma, you see? The Dharma that can be named, the Dharma that can be taught is not the true Dharma. It's not true ultimate reality. It's not the truth with a capital T. So just as a way, by way of conclusion, and then we'll take some questions if there are any. The radical statement, the Buddha taught no Dharma, reminds us of the central doctrine of the Dharma that the Buddha did not teach. And that is, if we want to be free, if we want to be liberated, you see, all of Buddhism is designed to get us liberated into nirvana or enlightenment, right? Awakening. Bodhi. If we want to be free, if we want to be liberated, we have to stop grasping. We have to stop the attachments. We have to stop the craving, the desire, over and over again for something we can hold on to, something we can attain or grasp to. And this attachment is found in the, as one of the links of the 12 links of dependent origination. It's called upadana in the Sanskrit. And then the commentators talk about four different kinds of grasping. So we'll end with those, just as a reminder that the Buddha taught no Dharma except for the idea that we should not grasp to Dharma. The first attachment is called clinging to pleasurable sensual experiences and objects of desire, kama in Sanskrit. This is one that we're all familiar with. We're not supposed to grasp to sensual objects as Buddhists. We're supposed to have some detachment from the objects of the senses. And so far, so good. A little bit of renunciation goes a long, long way when it comes to the objects of the senses. You know, most of us are led around by the nose, by our objects of senses all the time. So getting a little bit of detachment from this kind of clinging or upadana would be a really good idea. The second kind is a little more complex. The second kind of grasping is called the grasping to a belief in a truly existing entity called the self. Atmavada. The grasping to the philosophical viewpoint that there is indeed something we could call a self or a soul or something like that. And this kind of grasping is a little bit harder, even harder, to get rid of than the grasping to sensual pleasures, because it's very, very deeply ingrained in us. And then is encouraged philosophically and in common, you know, just in common sense, in common day interactions all the time. So that's the second kind of clinging, to try to let go of the me and mine that we cling to so, so tightly. The third kind, you ready? Clinging to viewpoints. Drishti in Sanskrit. Clinging to viewpoints. This means philosophical viewpoints. In some of the more conservative texts, they say, well, what it really means is clinging to false viewpoints, you know, like karma doesn't exist, or there is no such thing as past and future lives. But it actually doesn't say that. It says any viewpoint, clinging to any viewpoint, is a kind of a clinging to. And this understanding of what it means to cling to a viewpoint, clinging to any viewpoint, is a little bit legitimated, ratified by Nagarjuna, who says in the 13th chapter, 8th verse of the root verses, he says, emptiness has been taught by the conqueror as the refutation of all viewpoints, the refutation of all drishtis. Those for whom emptiness is a viewpoint are said to be hopeless. So Nagarjuna says, anything that you have to say, any dogma, any doctrine that you have to say about ultimate reality, about emptiness, is already showing that you don't know anything about emptiness. That you don't know the true things about emptiness. People like this are hopeless, clinging to that kind of idea, clinging to that drishti, to that philosophy of emptiness. Oh, we're the emptiness. We're the shunya, you know, vadins, shunyata vadins. We're the emptiness guys. And those other guys, oh, they don't believe in emptiness. And, you know, clinging like that to dogma, to doctrine, especially doctrine that separates you from other people, separates you from other doctrines, Nagarjuna says, you know, that's hopeless. You're just hopeless. Then the last kind of clinging is the clinging to moral strictures, shila. Shila is the exact word that they use for the second of the six perfections. the perfection of ethics, clinging to ethics, clinging to morals, or vrata. Vrata, means, technically it means a vow, religious practices in general. Clinging to your Buddhism, you could say. Clinging to your ideas of morality, your vows, and clinging to your practices is also a form of clinging. I think, it's coming forth for a reason. You see, it's among the last of the clingings to go. Clingings to drishti and clingings to, to the isms, the ologies, the dogmas, the practices. These are still clingings. These are still graspings. These two are attachments. But they're among the last attachments to go. So the spiritual life is kind of like this. We exchange one set of attachments for another at the beginning. We come to our dharma, we come to our practice with attachments to all kinds of things, to money, to relationships, to all kinds of things. And we exchange those attachments for a different kind of attachment. So we attach ourselves to our vows, we attach ourselves to our daily practices, we attach ourselves to meditation, we attach ourselves to all the kinds of, helpful, useful things that will lead for a better life, for a good life. But then the tendency is to get attached to them, to grasp to them. And at the later stages, we see teachings that we've got to leave those behind too. They're just rafts. They're just provisional. And grasping to them won't bring you where you need to go. That liberation, freedom, means also freedom from the dharma, freedom from the practices that brought you so far, freedom from the concepts and practices that brought you so far. Even those have to go. The Buddha taught no dharma that ultimately wasn't meant to be discarded in the quest for final liberation. The Buddha taught no dharma that wasn't meant to finally be discarded, to let go. Which is not to say that on the way to that place those attachments aren't useful. They are. They can be very, they're essential, I'd say. They are beneficial and essential to attach to morality, to attach to, working karma, to attach to, regulating your behavior, to attach to a regular meditation practice and so forth. These are all helpful, beneficial attachments, but they're still attachments too. And even they must go. Such illusions, they're illusions. They're not really, they're not the real dharma, you see. They're not the real ultimate dharma. They're just a provisional dharma. The Buddha taught no dharma that wasn't just provisional. Such illusions also have to go. Eventually have to go. So, just as a way of ending, again to quote from Arya Nagarjuna, this is how Arya Nagarjuna ends his root texts on the middle way, root verses on the middle way. He says, I bow down to him, to Gautama. He bows down to historical Buddha now. the very guy who sort of like, helps us like erase, attachments to the historical Buddha now bows down to the historical Buddha. I bow down to him, to Gautama, who out of compassion taught the true Dharma, Sad-Dharma, Sad-Dharma, Sat, like in Satya, Sad-Dharma. I bow down to him, to Gautama, who out of compassion taught the true Dharma in order to bring about the abandoning of all viewpoints, of all drishtis. Okay? That's what the Buddha really taught. The Buddha taught no Dharma that wasn't the abandonment of all Dharma, of teaching. The Buddha taught no Dharma that wasn't the teaching about abandoning all Dharma, eventually. Of not grasping to viewpoints. The true Dharma is that there is no Dharma that can be taught. The true Dharma that was taught is that there's no Dharma that can be taught, if you see what I mean. The Buddha taught no Dharma. So does that disillusion you? Does that disturb you? Does it sadden you? Does it anger you to hear that the Buddha taught no Dharma? And, if it does, well, I just say what the Dalai Lama always says, and that, well, never mind then, just never mind. Turn me off and try not to think about it. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to disturb you, but if you are disturbed, just never mind. But realize that I didn't invent these words. These aren't coming out of my mouth, from aboriginal, from some kind of thing that I just thought of. These are in the Buddhist scriptures, and in the most powerful of the Buddhist scriptures, in the Heart Sutra, in the Diamond Cutter Sutra, in Aryanagarjuna. This is what is taught, that the Buddha taught no Dharma. So at some point or another, you've got to deal with this. You got to figure out, well, what the hell do you think that means? You see, that the Buddha taught no Dharma. So at the end of the Diamond Sutra, actually, where, you know, poor Subhuti has just been getting it right and left from the Buddha, you know, on these kind of, from this angle, you see, Subhuti cries. Subhuti, at a certain point, he hears enough of this, and then because of the powerful effect of this Dharma teaching, what Dharma teaching? That there is no Dharma teaching. That the Buddha taught no Dharma. And because of the powerful effect of this Dharma teaching, the Venerable Subhuti shed tears. Wiping the tears from his eyes, he spoke to the Lord. It is truly wonderful, Lord, most wonderful. You who have gone to the good. This Dharma teaching spoken by the Tathagata for the purpose of leading living beings on the highest of all journeys, for the purpose of the best of all journeys, and from which, Lord, wisdom has arisen in me. Lord, I have never before heard such a Dharma teaching like this. Those bodhisattvas, Lord, who hear what is taught in this sutra, and in whom arises a clear understanding of the truth, will be supremely blessed. And why is this? Because, Lord, this clear understanding of the truth is not a clear understanding of the truth. And that is why the Tathagata speaks of the clear understanding of the truth as the clear understanding of the truth. Typical Diamond Cutter Sutra. So when Subhuti hears, you know, things similar to what we've been talking about for the last hour or so, he weeps. He cries. He says what the student in the Ashtavakra Gita says when he hears the truth from his teacher. He says, "Aho, oh my God, oh wow." And maybe you hear those words like that, you know, these words like that too. Maybe you sort of get the whiff, the smell of freedom, of true liberation from the phrase, "The Buddha taught no Dharma." Maybe that's how you're hearing it. But, and if so, you know, maybe tears are coming to your eyes. Maybe the tears of radical possibility, of enlightenment, of awakening in this very lifetime are arising in your mind. And if so, I'm glad that that was helpful. But in either case, whether you find it like repulsive and frightening and sad to hear that the Buddha taught no Dharma, or if you, like Subhuti, start shedding tears of joy, in either case, evam tvaya shrutam. That was heard by you. You see, what was heard by you? So, if you have any questions, please post them in the chat room, and we'll take a couple of them for a bit. Cindy is going to read them to me.
So there's one already. Lamaji, would it be correct to say that the true Dharma is potential, before speech or conceptualization?
Yeah, you could say it that way. I mean, that's kind of what emptiness is the condition of possibility for things. That it's a little bit like they say, empty space. You know, the condition of possibility. Can you all see this for this pen? You know the pen, right? Yeah. The condition of possibility for this pen to exist spatially is the empty space that it's now filling, and now it's not filling. See, it's vacating it's inhabiting empty space now. Now it's vacating that empty space. But that empty space, you could say that condition of possibility makes it possible for the pen to have a location, to exist. And emptiness is like that. Emptiness is the condition of possibility for form, for appearances. But it isn't appearances. It's the condition of possibility for appearances. And so it's a little bit subtle that way. To say that form is emptiness and emptiness is form, it has to be worked out kind of carefully. But you can say that one of the meanings of that phrase from the Heart Sutra, right, is that form has as its condition of possibility emptiness. And vice versa. There's no emptiness, no free-floating emptiness that doesn't adhere to form. So form is empty of having self-existence, but there is no emptiness without the form that is empty of self-existence. Form exists because it's empty of having any kind of essence to it. It exists as a changing thing, as a as an impermanent thing, and so forth, because it is empty. So form is emptiness, and emptiness is form, in that they are two ways of talking about the same kind of phenomenon, but they are talking about it from two different points of view.
You were saying in the Heart Sutra retreat that prajna, the pra in prajna, means before finding out.
Yeah, Cindy is reminding me that etymologically, the word prajna, which is the Sanskrit word for wisdom, it means before, and the jna means wisdom. Prajna means the prognosis. The word prognosis is the exact English equivalent, actually. Prognosis means that you know something before it's happened, actually. Prognosis, right? So prajna means, prajna, the wisdom, in this sense, can mean the wisdom about what's possible before it manifests. What's possible, you see, and that's emptiness. Emptiness means it has infinite potentiality, infinite possibility, and then it manifests as one or another of the possibilities of infinite potentiality, and then knowing how it manifests is a different kind of knowledge. Prajna is knowing its potential. Then you know, vijna or vijnana or some other word is sometimes used for understanding how form actually, you know, manifests.
Yeah. So you can put prajna and vijna together.
Sometimes they do. Prajna is wisdom and vijnana as kind of knowledge, you know, like the knowledge that science has on how things that have manifested do exist. But prajna means the condition of possibility for any kind of form to exist. The condition of possibility, the emptiness, the infinite potential that things, that all things have.
we actually, can you just announce to people that they should write in the social stream, not in the chat, because we're in the social stream?
I'm supposed to ask you to write in the social stream part of this Ustream page, and not in the chat part, because we can't read the chat part for some reason.
So, you don't have any more questions right now, but...
So there's no more questions. Maybe I should stop. If there's any more questions, they should come like pretty quick.
How do people know when they should detach from their morality, their emptiness meditations, etc.?
Cindy's just making up questions to fill up time. She's asking a very, very important question, of course, how do you know when you're ready to start working on detaching from the attachments that you have to your own practice? And that's a very, very, very important and tricky question. And as usual, the answer to the question is because your teacher told you. And so at a certain point, I think, a student will be told by a good teacher, by a good teacher, that they need to start being practicing freedom, but that presumes probably lifetime training in discipline first. Freedom doesn't come from the absence of discipline. Freedom comes through discipline, but discipline itself is not freedom. And so I think a student's teacher will at some point sort of indicate to them that it's now time to start practicing freedom from discipline instead of the discipline in order to get free. The discipline in order to get free is prior, and that for most of us will be our whole lifetime, will be this whole lifetime, is practicing discipline in order to move towards freedom. But at a certain point, discipline itself has to be dropped as well, because freedom comes from discipline, but it isn't discipline. Freedom is freedom from discipline. You could also say, you see, it's freedom from any kind of constriction. You see, any kind of constriction. And again, we'll address this kind of stuff in very great detail, and with some sophistication, in the Ashtavakra Gita course offered by the Yoga Studies Institute through the Yoga Studies Institute online. And also, I believe it will be archived and people can access it that way as well. But we'll be doing it from, the last two weekends of April and the first weekend in May. And the timings are all up on the yogastudiesinstitute.org website, so check it out.
We've got two more questions.
Two more questions.
Mm-hmm. Could I ask why you chose this special teaching? It was advanced and substantial.
It was advanced and substantial?
It was.
Well, good. I'm glad you thought so.
Why did you choose it, though?
Why did I choose it?
Yeah.
Well, it's for a number of different reasons. I guess first and foremost is it's just something that's really it's really been important to me. It's something that I've been thinking about a lot, and I think oftentimes when you're giving a teaching, it's really good to give a teaching that you're interested in, that you're kind of like enthused about. Of course, we're required to do, as Dharma teachers, we're required to teach at all different levels and teach the same thing over and over again oftentimes, and to do so with enthusiasm. But, I'm especially interested in this kind of thing these days. And so it just was kind of selfishly something I wanted to talk about and work out. This is the first time I've given this teaching. It's a little bit like the first pancake, it comes out a little bit. Maybe a little bit misshapen, but maybe it'll get better over time. Secondly, I think, one of the reasons I am interested in this and I wanted to share it with you is because, we're not, I live in rural Australia, but nowadays, you can kind of be plugged in no matter where you are. So, I listen to a lot of podcasts from other Buddhist teachers and, have some sense of what's going out there. And I'm very worried personally that sometimes the tendency is to reify Buddhism and to say, this is what Buddhism is. And if you don't believe this, and if you don't practice this, then you're not a Buddhist. And, there's a kind of, there's a tendency in all of us towards fundamentalism. And I think it would be a huge, huge mistake and a huge like blowing of an opportunity as Buddhism comes new to places like the West, to then just recodify it and put it into some kind of orthodoxy again, and make it a club that some people are in and some people aren't in. That's not my understanding of real Buddhism. Real Buddhism is not to like set ourselves apart from others, but to help us like see our connections to others, and to do that means in breaking down the attachments that we are often sort of have towards just another doctrine, another set of doctrines, another set of ideas, another set of sacred texts that are that are ours and that are better than other people's and so forth. So that's another sort of stimulation for this particular teaching.
We got four more questions.
All right.
Is the first glimpse of the true Dharma the direct perception of emptiness?
Yes, I would say that. Well, that's right. I mean, of course, up until the direct perception of emptiness, we have more and more refined and deep intellectual understandings of emptiness. So I guess you could say the first glimpses really to ultimate truth, to the ultimate Dharma, Saddharma, the true Dharma, is through our inklings, intellectual inklings, that we get through study and through taking teachings and giving teachings like this. But the true conviction, of course, that there is something beyond words, that there is a reality that lies beyond conceptualization, beyond doctrine, beyond words, that would come with the direct perception of emptiness.
Here's a good question for some fine distinctions. Is it useful for someone trying to keep morality to know that morality will eventually be dropped?
Yes, I think it's very useful, actually. I mean, I don't think it does anybody any good to pretend that their set of moralities is the only and best one. It closes you off. It closes your mind off to other possibilities, to other people, to other ways of life, to other religions, to think that your way of doing things, your morality, your set of ethics are the best and only ones. So I think it's a very, very important skill that a practitioner has to simultaneously say, these are the ones that I'm adopting. These are the ones that I'm following. These are the ones that I've vowed to follow, you know, if you've taken vows. Simultaneously with the idea that these are just one set among many, that things are relative. See, that is Buddhism. Buddhism is teaching relativism. It's teaching things exist dependently, not independently. A set of vows, a set of ethics that were objectively the best, the, you know, the ones that everyone should follow and so forth, would be a self-existing thing. That's not empty. The vows are as empty, the morality is as empty as anything else. Which doesn't mean it's not useful, of course. So to have this kind of ability, you can think of it as the ability to drive with the accelerator floored and the brake on at the same time. The accelerator floored means, in this case, like, yes, I've taken, I have adopted this set of morality, this set of morality, of ethics fits me. Maybe it was given to me by a teacher that, you know, I have a close relationship to. Maybe I've even taken vows. This is the one that I'm going to, this is the brand that I'm going to follow. But there are plenty of other ones that exist for other people, and that's fine for them too. You see, as long as certain sort of criteria are in place, okay? There are some kind of criteria that are not relative, you know, because they just don't work. A moral viewpoint that suggests it's a good idea to hurt other people and to be as selfish as possible isn't going to work because of the way karma works, because of the way things are working in dependent origination. So you can say that that kind of morality, you have to put it in quotes, is not really morality at all. Selfishness and harming others. That kind of ideology or belief system is wrong in the sense that it doesn't work. It doesn't function to bring the happiness to people that they're looking for. And so you can make judgments like that. You can say, no, that set doesn't work. Like much of what's, you know, being purveyed in consumer capitalism nowadays. You know, it just doesn't work. It's dysfunctional. So, but there are plenty of other ones. There are plenty of other sets of, you know, moral guidelines that are functional and that differ from one tradition to another, and that's fine.
I think too, he's asking that you know that morality will eventually be dropped, but you're not really going to ever drop. You're not going to drop the idea that you shouldn't hurt others.
No.
That you've retrained yourself for that to be your natural instinct. So you're not going to eventually drop that as a. Right? You're retraining, so it's not dropping your morality, it's that you're naturally according to reality.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, what Cindy's suggesting here is that it's not so much the dropping of the morality as the thorough assimilation of the morality, such that it's second nature now. So you can think of it that way, that the process of discipline, the process of rehabituating yourself to a functional way of life, to a happy way of life, to the kinds of actions that would further your happiness rather than undermine it. When those strictures, moral strictures, become second nature to you, then there's no need for them to be moral strictures at all. You see, then you can drop them because, in a way, you could say they've dropped automatically because. Your mind has changed. You would never think to do anything other than, you know, not lie, not harm others, you know, not use your speech to divide people, etc. You see. So this is again something that we'll go into in the Ashtavakra Gita teachings with the Yoga Studies Institute on what it means, because, you know, in texts like that, as well as texts that you can find in other traditions. There's this idea that the free person is beyond morality, that a truly liberated person is beyond right and wrong. And then we have to investigate, well, what the hell does that mean? Does that mean that they just don't care what's right and what's wrong? And of course it doesn't mean that. It means that the choice has been eliminated, that they don't sit around going, well, what should I do? Should I do the right thing or should I do the wrong thing? Because they have so thoroughly rehabilitated themselves, rehabituated themselves, that the right thing is the only thing that they would do, you see? So there's no right and wrong in the sense of some kind of dichotomy between right and wrong. It's only right, you could say. Yeah. In which case, it doesn't really make any sense to say it's right versus wrong, you see? So they're beyond morality in that sense.
What is the proper way to ask for a teaching, special teaching, from your Lama? Do you wait for the teacher to tell you you are ready, or... do you ask when you think you are ready?
Well, if you ask your teacher something directly, you better be prepared to get the answer. And if, you know, if you have an answer in mind and the teacher gives you the wrong answer, then you're kind of screwed. You see what I mean? Then you have to work at it a little bit. So, you know, generally speaking, you know, if you're interested in asking your teacher directly a question, then do what the, you know, then be open to the answer and try to do it. If you suspect something that your teacher has tried to teach you, if you feel that you already know the answer, then the teacher is teaching you at a deeper level. You see, the teacher is teaching you, you know, the inner guru is at work. The outer guru has conveyed to the inner guru something, and then you can listen to the inner guru. But if you can't hear the inner guru, then you better listen to the outer guru.
All right. So how does this kind of anti-fundamentalism jive with maintaining an authentic lineage? What's the middle way?
There is no authentic lineage for you apart from your teacher. Your teacher is the lineage. Your teacher is the portal to the lineage. And so the whole question of authentic lineage, from my point of view, can be concentrated into the question of the guru. Because the guru is your one and only link to any authentic lineage. One and only. So then we can repose the question and say, well, how does this whole question of orthodoxy relate to, you know, to guru yoga? And I would argue that the real guru yoga is beyond orthodoxy. That there is no orthodoxy when it comes to guru yoga. There is guru doxy. There's no orthodoxy. It's what the guru says, you see. And so there's no Buddhism for a Buddhist apart from the Buddhism that's taught to them by a teacher. So the guru is everything, you see. The guru is the Buddha, the guru is the Dharma, the guru is the Sangha. Everything comes down to the guru. So no problem, I'd say. No problem. There's no possibility for either orthodoxy or heterodoxy when it comes to guru yoga, I would say. There's just guru yoga, you see. You're just learning from a Buddha who you really are. And so that has nothing to do with, like, you know, with some kind of, like, some sort of abstraction, like an authentic lineage. An authentic lineage is an abstraction. It's as much of it's very similar kind of abstraction as the idea of history, which is also an abstraction. There's no authentic lineage apart from your guru, for you. So it all comes down to the guru.
What's the advantage of resting on a full lineage then? Why don't we just put our own lama's picture on our websites or whatever? What's the purpose of invoking the lineage every time we do the sadhana and that kind of thing?
To help others. To help others gain some faith, that's all. But I think at a deeper level, a true practitioner, a practitioner who has, like, thought things through, realizes that there is no authentic lineage outside of their relationship with their guru. Yeah.
But when it's hard with your own lama, don't you think it helps them to think that they have their own teacher?
It helps. Yeah, and it gives you faith too, of course. It gives you some faith in your teacher to realize that your teacher has had a teacher, you know, an authoritative teacher who has had a teacher and so forth. But these are, again, just an abstraction. You don't really know who those are. We don't know, for example, in our lineage, we don't know who Pabunka Rinpoche is. All we know is, you know, what Pabunka Rinpoche taught as it's been taught to us by our guru. That's what we know, you see. We don't know what the Buddha taught. We don't know what Pabunka Rinpoche. We don't know what Jetsong Kapa taught. We know what the Buddha, what our Lama has taught us about what they taught. Okay?
So can you give people an idea of the way they could look at what Geshe-la is doing with Pabunka's text now, of how they should sit in that classroom and see who's teaching the Buddha?
It's the same. You made the same point before. The Lam Rim is quite specific on it, quite clear, and, you know, it eludes us because it's so obvious. that there is no Buddha apart from the Guru who's teaching you. You see, that is the Buddha. That's the only Buddha that there ever has been, ever will be for you, is the Buddha who's teaching you. The Buddha does not exist apart from the actions of the Buddha. And the actions of the Buddha are teaching you the Dharma. And if somebody's teaching you the Dharma, that's the Buddha. Period. Full stop. And then, you know, so now go and work that out. Mm-hmm. Go and put that in your pipe and smoke it. That's, you know, the whole idea that there's all these other Buddhas around is, again, a kind of an abstraction. It's just a kind of an intellectual exercise. The only contact that you have ever had with a Buddha is with a contact with a being who's teaching you the Dharma. And that's the only Buddha that will ever exist for you. That's the only Buddha. So it all comes down to Guru Yoga, doesn't it? Yeah. Someday we'll do a whole teaching on Guru Yoga for those who contribute nicely to the Mahasukha Kula Retreat Scholarship.
We should have had a little sign. Can you tell people the address again?
Yeah, it's for those of you who want to, please donate to our retreat fund. It's the www.retreatscholarship.org website, and they'll give you plenty of instructions there on how you can easily donate. And yeah, we'd really appreciate it. Okay, guys, thank you very much for joining us, and I hope this was at least a little bit useful, and thanks for the questions, and thanks for deferring, you know, watching grown men playing ball with each other, and now you can go and do that live, I think, for those of you who are watching live, you can catch the rest of the Super Bowl. Okay, thanks.